This is Mark Steiner. Welcome back. We're going to go to our National News Roundtable. And the coming Fridays from here on in, you'll hear our national and international news roundtables, and then other roundtables on local and state news as well coming up. We are joined here this hour by welcome back, Shed Johnson, news director at WVAS in Montgomery, Alabama. Shed, welcome back.
Well, thank you for having me.
Great to hear your voice again.
I'm sorry?
Great to hear your voice again.
I appreciate that.
Show.
I appreciate it. It's good to be part of you again.
Lenny McAllister is with us, conservative media personality, public speaker, writer, commentator. Lenny, welcome back.
Mark, thanks for having me again.
Edward Wyckoff Williams returns, of course, author, columnist, and regular contributor to The Root. We'll be talking about one of his theses about the coming elections and Democrats and Republicans as well during the course of this conversation. Edward, welcome back.
A pleasure to be with you.
And Jordan Bloom, associate editor of The American Conservative. And Jordan, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Folks, join us here at 410-319-8888. We've got a couple of lines open. You can join us here. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Log on to our Facebook page and put your questions there on the issues of the day that we're going to be raising. Or you can just join us and tweet us at Mark Steiner. Let me just pick up, gentlemen, where we left off a moment ago with this George Zimmerman trial. And I'm curious, in a larger sense, where you think this trial takes America, what it will, what do you think the trial will create in its wake for us to wrestle with? Lenny?
I think that, for one, we'll finally start tangling with the issue of race in the 21st century. I think that we've obviously tackled it in the 20th and 19th centuries, obviously. But this is an opportunity for people to really look at their politics, their views on race, and look at their honest perception of where we are with race in America. It's something I wrote about in Politics 365. I actually wrote about this in A Root previously as well, that, you know, you look at issues such as Stand Your Ground. It's okay. There's a lot of conservatives that are Second Amendment people looking at Stand Your Ground when it comes to George Zimmerman. But with Mr. McNeil or with Ms. Alexander in Florida, or Georgia and Florida respectively, they flipped a script and it no longer was applicable. So again, you have to start asking yourself, when you look at the double unemployment, when you look at issues of violence, when you look at something like Stand Your Ground in this case with Trayvon Martin, race still matters. And for any conservative or liberal or people that are not really engaged in politics or civics, to sit there and look at this case and not understand how this can be a powder keg in regards to where we are racially in America, they're ignoring all of what goes into this case.
Shed, how do you see it?
Well, I don't disagree with what was just said, but I put out this sort of theory about it, is that we'll have the initial conversations, especially after the incident surfaced and it got all the national media attention that it could possibly get. I think there's still that uncomfortable factor when dealing with matters of race. And like I said, everything, all the debates and all the issues that led to, the confrontation, something that I'm sure that happens a lot across this nation. Like I said, we'll have the initial conversation, but matters of race, Mark, make a lot of people uncomfortable, and I think that in the long run, it'll be shoved to the background.
Huh, that's interesting, Jordan.
Well, I think there absolutely are a lot of lessons about race in America that we can kind of draw from the Zimmerman case, but exactly what those lessons are going to be, I think it's an open question until the trial actually happens. I think if Zimmerman's found innocent, there are going to be a lot of people that are upset with that.
Edward?
Mark, yesterday I interviewed Tracy Martin, Trayvon Martin's father, and Benjamin Crump, the family attorneys, for a piece that I'm doing for Father's Day, to get his ideas specifically on how the Mark O'Mara's team, so George Zimmerman's legal team, have been really strategic at trying to use old racial codes in order to frame the child victim, not just as the predator, but also releasing information, his text messages, the fact that he may have smoked marijuana, somehow to frame him as a thug and to taint the jury pool as a result. And the father, obviously, is still grieving and will forever be, and so mostly just talked about how it's important that people understand that from his perspective, my kid was just a good kid, and they shouldn't be doing that, right? He's the victim in this case. So I think that that's important. But what Benjamin Crump said was even all the more important, I think. He said that actually this is bigger, and I think we all agree about this, that this is so much bigger than the confrontation that happened between the 17-year-old Trayvon and the 28-year-old George Zimmerman that ended in Trayvon's death. He said that this is going to set a legal precedent. And I think that that's the bigger issue. So that whether or not, well, if George Zimmerman actually walks, it's going to say not just to police authorities who abuse power, but to these Second Amendment fanatics, I would call them, who believe that stand your ground is necessary to protect themselves against black and brown people and the government trying to come to take their guns. I think that if this case goes horribly wrong, that's the kind of precedent that we're going to see. And that's going to be a sad day in America.
And, Mark, if I may add to that very quickly.
Who's
very,
that?
Very
is this
quickly.
Lenny?
If you look at 1992 and what happened with the Rodney King trial and how those individuals got off initially, 91, 92, if you can take that anger and that frustration and add social media and how much more connected we are as a world, if Zimmerman gets off in this case, we really are going to be dealing with a level of frustration and anger that can be just quite dangerous for any American and all the progress that we've made over the years.
And who was trying to jump in there? I couldn't tell.
Mark, this is Shed. That was me. I was curious, and I lost track of this, and I'm embarrassed to even admit this. How did the judge rule on whether he would allow Zimmerman's attorneys to introduce the marijuana and some other matters? Did he say he would allow that to be admitted in court?
She said no, they will not be admitted in court, though there's an argument.
That's not exactly true. She said that his past as a marijuana user couldn't be admitted, but if he was on it at the time, if it was in his system, then it could be admitted.
Right.
So a little bit of nuance there.
The nuance was that if they make the argument that he was high, that toxicology report from might be admitted.
Okay.
But the other issues could not be admitted. And she was not going to allow those to come in about his past. But maybe another kind of piece of this, and I just want to see what you all think. I raised this to the reporter who is covering the trial, Janae Desmond Harris, a moment ago, but let me raise it to the four of you. What is the fuel in this nation, if anything, when news outlets like Fox put up on their screen, as example, there's a picture of George Zimmerman, beaten, battered, looking forlorn, sad, and upset. There's a picture of Trayvon Martin next to him, darkened and looking the way they want him to look, which is like angry, mean, like a black thug. What is that setting up for us, Jordan?
Well, there are all sorts of problematic portrayals. I mean, there were a couple of instances of people actually using pictures of someone that wasn't actually Trayvon, which is, you know, even worse. But there was also, you know, one of the photos that was most frequently used of Trayvon was several years old, and it was, you know, of him looking, I guess, you know, fairly angelic. So you can make this portrayal comment in pretty much any direction, depending on who's, you know, who's trying to say what. But what does it say? I don't really know. Our lingering racial animosity, I guess.
I can't disagree with that. I think you know, when you mentioned the Fox angle on this, is that the photos that I have seen is definitely, to me, at least the impression I get, is to make him look as menacing as possible, playing into those racial stereotypes that we fought so hard to try to dispel, but it's very interesting how you would see him portrayed Fox as opposed to maybe one of the other mainstream networks like NBC or CBS.
Len, do you have a new take on this?
Well, I think we know what's going on here, and it's unfortunate. I think people will play to stereotypes in order to get ratings and then question why this had such an effect on society. I think it's a very, it's playing naive is just the height of irresponsibility when you're leading, whether it's in media or in civics. And unfortunately, some institutions and some organizations have an opportunity to lead in both, and they choose not to.
Edward, as we go to break, any closing thought on this before we switch subjects?
Well, no, I really don't. I agree with what all the gentlemen said, but I will add that we all should agree that Fox News is a propaganda machine, especially for the far right, but conservatives in general, but especially for the far right. And so I can't trust much of anything they report on.
Well, I appreciate all these folks are calling in, so we'll see if we can get these calls here in just a minute. We have to take a very brief break right now from the top of the hour, hit some news locally and nationally. And we'll come back to our guests. We're going to touch on the controversy over the Washington football team's name and what some congressional folks are doing to change that. We want to look as well as what Edward Wyckoff Williams is writing. Many people think it easily means that elections have changed forever. The Republicans may not win anymore, but that may not be the case. We'll wrestle with that and look at all the indictments and around freedom of press issues in the Obama administration. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner on our National News Roundtable. We are joined here today by our four guests, Shed Johnson, News Director WVAS in Montgomery, Alabama, Lenny McAllister, conservative media personality, public speaker, writer, and commentator, Edward Wyckoff Williams, author, columnist, and regular contributor to The Root, and more, Jordan Bloom, associate editor of The American Conservative. Number here is 410-319-8888. Before we jump into our next subject, let's run to the phones here and go to Chuck Ross, calling us from Wichita, Kansas. Chuck, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Your thoughts?
Yes, I have three really quick thoughts. I'll try to be concise.
All right.
I'll just point out, I agree with Jordan Bloom there, whenever you said that Fox News and other outlets have depicted George Zimmerman as being, you know, battered and bruised and downtrodden, and Trayvon Martin as being a thug. I agree with Jordan that it was the reverse at the beginning, where Trayvon Martin was portrayed as angelic, and they kind of showed some OJ-esque pictures of George Zimmerman when he had been previously arrested. That's my first point. Second point is that there hasn't been much talk about some of the other social media and text messages where Trayvon Martin was interested in obtaining a gun, which I think is somewhat significant, especially considering Zimmerman says that Trayvon Martin was kind of trying to reach for his gun during their struggle. That's up for debate whether that actually happened or not. Final point is that I think it's kind of, we don't need to necessarily talk about this in mutually exclusive terms, in the sense that Zimmerman could be guilty of some sort of profiling. And he was definitely wrong in approaching Trayvon Martin. I mean, that's we know that because Trayvon Martin didn't have a weapon. But also, at the same time, that doesn't mean that Zimmerman is necessarily guilty of second-degree murder. It requires that he's of a depraved mind, irregardless of human life. So, you know, there's not a way for the law to handle someone like seeing a young black kid and thinking that he's up to no good. There's no way for the law to handle that, but that doesn't mean that he's guilty of second-degree murder.
All right, Chuck, thanks so much. Thank you so much for your thoughts. Edward, why don't you jump on this first?
I think there is a way for the law to handle that. I think the caller made some interesting points, but was a little confused. He said, we're not sure if Trayvon was reaching for a gun. We all know Trayvon wasn't reaching for a gun because he had no gun to reach for. He had Skittles and iced tea. I think that there's something deeply depraved about the mind of a man who stalks any child in the dark. And so I think second-degree murder is the right charge here, not manslaughter. This is my problem with this entire situation, particularly around young black males, is that they're never seen as children. They're never seen as victims. They're always seen as an equal match to either a group of police officers who want to put 50 bullets in them, or a grown-ass man, excuse my language, but a grown man with a gun. And this idea that somehow Trayvon was equally matched to this man and should have sort of won the fight, right? That it should be Trayvon who should be asking for a stand-your-ground defense when he was up against an enemy and an obstacle that he would never have won against. And so it's very, very clear that there's something wrong with the mind of George Zimmerman, and I think I think the second-degree murder charge is exactly what the prosecutor should have gone for.
And if I may, you guys also ahead.
You have to also take in consideration a couple of things. Number one, Zimmerman was told not to follow him. The police said, we got this. Don't follow
him.
You follow him anyway. So now you're talking about an intended act where you are told by an authority to stop a pursuit that you continue on. So you have to question the mindset there, number one. And number two, what we continue to talk about, I mean, the O'Meara team wants to continue to bring in images and text messages of Trayvon's, you know, last months of life, but we continue to not talk about George Zimmerman's past of domestic violence. We continue to not talk about George Zimmerman's past of other violent acts. When you come into the context of this, so when you start talking about a depraved mind, you also have to start talking about a past pattern of violence, and George Zimmerman meets that description. And by the way, the George Zimmerman that appeared in court, that had lost all that weight and had a bulletproof vest on, is not the George Zimmerman that Trayvon Martin encountered. He encountered somebody that weighed more than 100 pounds more than him and was roughly 10 years older than him, that had a past towards violence, that leaned towards violent acts, and he had already just ignored the police. So let's put this in the proper context of somebody having Skittles and iced tea. From the other side of the aisle, we never talk about what Zimmerman was armed with as far as his past. We always want to sit here and focus on a 17-year-old black boy and try to make him out to be a thug, and that's just ridiculous.
Let me move on to another subject here. A couple things I do want to hit on our roundtable here. And folks, please join us at 410-319-8888. Many of our listeners who are not listening online but listening here on the radio live in the Washington, D.C. area, both Montgomery County, Prince George's County, Northern Virginia, and D.C. itself. We'd like to hear your thoughts at 410-319-8888. There's now a push in Congress. We've covered this a lot before Congress did this, with 10 congressmen saying that the Washington football team should change its name. And of course, the owner has said, no, we're not going to change the name. How important is this to us? I mean, when, you know, the majority of Americans in polls are saying they don't think that, almost 80% of the people are saying they don't think that the team should be forced to change its name. Yet the name, many people would argue, Jordan Bloom, is a, since you're in D.C., let me start with you, is just an outright racist name.
Well, I think that the question you got to ask when determining that is, what do Native Americans think? And all the polling indicates that they don't, contrary to the letter written by 10 congressmen. But in 2004, there, Annenberg did a study that found that only 9% of Native Americans actually found the term offensive. Sports Illustrated did one in 2002, and it was just 75. Or it was 75 found it just fine. And so the comparison that gets trotted out a lot is you know, what if there were a team named after, you know, the N-word or another derogatory term for black people? And the problem with that is that Redskin, going back to the 17th century, there's some evidence that Native American tribes applied that term to themselves. And so I just don't really think it's an appropriate comparison. But the thing we really have to, that I think is really dangerous about this whole thing, is that those congressmen are trying to use the trademark system to bully the team into changing their name. And that's really the problem. They're saying, under this, you know, this framework that we've determined, if we decide that your team name is offensive, you don't have exclusive rights to it now. So what that means is I could immediately, once that trademark is struck down, I could start a company and start selling Redskins T-shirts, which I couldn't do before. So you're taking away their branding and possibly even opening it up to more of this offensive imagery being disseminated. It just makes no sense.
Anybody else want to weigh in before I weigh in here? Edward?
I struggle with this one. I think that I'm not quite sure why all of a sudden this has become a controversy when the name and the word in itself has been considered offensive for so long. I think that this is a country that slaughtered these Native people. And so if there was a consensus among that community that this was offensive, I think they should definitely change the name. I wonder what Americans, and American Jews in particular, would think if Germany had some football team, a soccer team there, and the name of that team was a derogatory of Jews. Like, I think that we would be outraged. And so I put it in that kind of context, and I think, well, if I were Native American and I were offended, I would be outraged that everybody else wasn't. And to that end, I think that that they should really give this some consideration.
I mean, let me kind of push a little further, then we'll move on to another subject and get to this caller calling in from Annapolis. I mean, I don't know how Annenberg conducted their poll. I know that people on reservations in the native communities and inner cities use that word much the same way that you hear the N-word being used on the street in inner city communities of America between black folks. That doesn't mean that the word is not a derogatory word. It doesn't mean that the word is not a racist word, that it was used a lot by settlers in this country to say who we're going to kill. And if you look at the caricatures they have, the caricatures that the Cleveland Indians have on their mascot, it's nothing but, it's like a black Sambo writ in red.
Yeah, that's actually deeply offensive. I find that absolutely offensive.
So the question is, I mean, I'm curious why people, especially folks in the D.C. area, are kind of not saying you should change your name. I've talked to some people who think they should start a campaign to say we'll watch the game on television. We'll cook out outside the stadium. We're not buying tickets anymore. That
well, might again, them. I think it's a completely open question as to what Native Americans actually think.
I don't really think it is.
Well, just recently there was the chief of a Virginia tribe who said he'd be offended if the team did change their name. And but if I could just make a counterintuitive point, if the name were changed, we'd probably get some sort of patriotic-themed team with red, white, and blue colors. And if there's something to be said for having a team named after Native Americans, Redskins or not, it's that... It's a sort of, I don't know, memento mori of sorts. You know, it's the Coliseum of D.C., and they're whispering in the Empire's ear that, you know, you weren't here forever, and you probably won't be here in perpetuity. So if there's something that the Redskins, if there's significance to that being in D.C., I think that's it.
But why are we just focused on the Washington Redskins? The Atlanta Braves, when they go to the playoffs, they do the tomahawk chop, and they do a chant during any type of rally inning. You have the Cleveland Indians that tried to do the same exact thing. So why are we not talking about at least three major sport leagues team at one time? Why is this only focused on the football team? Is it because the NFL makes the most amount of money? Is it because Atlanta and Cleveland just kind of fade it back into the background and let the Redskins and their organization be at the forefront of this? Is it because they have RG3 and they have a well-recognized star? Why is this coming up with only one team? If this is a truly offensive term, let's look at the other caricatures that were out there. For example, you look at Miami University out of Ohio, they changed their name. You look at St. John's up in New York, they changed their mascot name because of offensive terms. So it has a precedent doing that, but to focus on just one sports team is not appropriate. So this seems to be targeted at one organization for a reason that we may or may not know right
well,
now.
Only because I agree, and I think they should all be targeted, just like the San Francisco Warriors changed their emblem from a racist caricature of a Native American to the bridge going over the San Francisco Bay, and kept the name Warriors, but then took all the kind of racial overtones out of it. I think it's a very real issue, and I think that many polling companies have no idea how to poll among Native Americans. All I know is that my intimate knowledge of living on a res in other places, that people find the name offensive when it's used by somebody who's not native. Let's go to Don in Annapolis. You're on the air. Then we'll switch subjects. Don, you're on the air.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
My point is, I think they should change the name. I mean, I think that if it was called Washington Blackskins, everybody would be outraged with it. As far as the teams, the fans, we already know they're going to keep the name basically because of the revenue and the money stream. But just like when the Baltimore Colts, when the Colts left Baltimore and went to Indianapolis, and the Baltimore Ravens, which wasn't even in existence, had to come up with a new name because the name went with the team to Indianapolis. At first, people had a problem with it because of all the history that came along with the Baltimore Colts name. But if the team starting to win, and you best believe, especially with technology, with these new fans and these more open-minded young people, they're going to follow the team. They're not going to have a problem filling the stadium if they decide to change their name. So that's just my point. I think they should step up, do the right thing. And the reason why I think they're going after the NFL, because the NFL is more powerful than anybody as far as professional sports. Once they chop off that part of the tree and make them change their mindset, and then I think they'll go after some of the smaller professional sports teams.
Don, thank you so much for your thoughts from Annapolis. Fox, let me switch gears. I wanted to kind of go to another subject here in the last part of our conversation, try to get one or two subjects in if we can. But let me just start with something I was really struck by, because there are some people who have written that there's a huge demographic shift in America, and that demographic shift clearly indicates there will be no majority in America in the coming years, and that shift was shown in the Obama campaigns when communities of color came out and put him over the top when 43% of white Americans in the first election in 2008 voted for Barack Obama, and they see this as an unstoppable locomotive for the future. However, Edward Wyckoff Williams, let's start this. You wrote a piece that challenges that whole notion.
Yes, because specifically of gerrymandering, the way that Republicans have gerrymandered districts means that they can continue to win, particularly during midterm elections. They can continue to own the House. They could take a majority of the Senate. And because of historical trends in voter turnout in midterms, people tend to stay home, particularly the Democratic-based supporters. So African-Americans, Hispanics, young voters of all races, they being the Republican Party, have a real advantage. And so a part of what I did was that I interviewed Steve Israel, Representative Steve Israel from New York, who is the chairman of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. And I also talked to Representative Elijah Cummings, who gave me some wonderful insight about how he thinks that Democrats don't realize that it's going to be extremely difficult to mobilize their base supporters that came out in droves in 2008 and came out in droves in 2012 again, when Barack Obama is not at the top of the ticket. And then I talked to Steve Israel specifically about what I see as a real problem and a potentially fatal blind spot in the Democratic Party, which is that they are not running enough black and brown people who are in the pipeline to be in the Senate, to be congressmen, to be governors, so that rainbow coalition is broadly represented. And I think the Senate, obviously, is a real problem because it really remains an old white boys' network. And Democrats don't seem bothered by that at all. Republicans have a black senator from South Carolina. What do Democrats have? An interim senator in Massachusetts who we all know that seat will end up going to one of the two front runners, which are both white males.
So
there's something problematic about the way that the Democratic Party isn't thinking about who they're running and then how they're going to mobilize their base voters to win in 2014.
Jordan Blum, what's your take on this?
Well, I think what Ed's saying makes a lot of sense, and part of that has to do with how redistricting works to benefit Democrats. And in one way, in Virginia, I think we all remember the controversy over the redistricting plan in the Virginia State Senate that was kind of shoehorned through as one Democratic black Democratic senator was away at the inauguration. Well, the thing that nobody mentioned about that is that there's a majority-minority state Senate district in Southside Virginia that the Democrats have consistently opposed creating because they want to draw the black neighborhoods into other Democratic districts to make them more competitive rather than having a unified majority-minority district that would, in all likelihood, elect some sort of a black leader. So, you know, there are definitely some tensions in this redistricting thing. It's not just about empowering Republicans.
Shed, how do you see it?
Well, I was just listening to Edward a minute ago, and I was curious. There's got to be or has something been put forth to say, what can we do to draw people out for midterms? What is it out there that keeps people at the polls? And I was listening to the comment that unless President Obama is at the top of the ticket, an election doesn't generate any interest. But there must be something out there that can draw people out. And I'm curious, Edward, as to whether they threw any sort of a strategy or theory your way as to how they can do that.
Yeah, well, it's not all doom and gloom. The DCC is essentially trying to use the Obama for America blueprint to keep people on the ground. So they're actually starting to replicate the platform that Obama put in place in 2008, keeping offices open in states like Florida and Ohio to have people going door to door. They're literally doing a door-to-door campaign, knocking on people's doors, making sure they're registered. And I want to say specifically about the lower voter turnout in midterm elections. What we saw in 2010 was really interesting is that African-American youth, their percentage of turnout actually went up, but it didn't match what it had been in 2008. And that was true across the board pretty much for African-Americans and Hispanics. It was young white voters who had voted for Obama in 2008 who actually stayed home in 2010. And so the strategy, I think, is to literally get those young people involved and then get those young people going to those communities, those black and brown communities, and making sure they drive people to the polls. Because what the Republican Party has been really, really good at doing is keeping their base angry enough. And their base tends to be older, whiter, and wealthier, and those people tend to vote anyway. So that's a part of why it has to. The Democrats have to actually have a real strategy.
I mean, just in the interest of time, Lenny, I haven't heard from you. I'd like your take on this.
Well, number one, I think gerrymandering has helped both parties. I think that there have been a lot of backroom deals that make sure that certain districts, primarily the Congressional Black Caucus districts, stay just the way they are to make sure that there are definitely Democrats and black Democrats represented in office, in Congress. I apologize about that. I'm at an NPR office. But as well, you also have to look at the fact that the Democrats have not really created the type of farm team that is diverse, like Edward was saying, that they need to create. I think that the Republicans can keep people angry. But even with President Obama at the top of the ticket, part of the problem with Republicans is the fact that they haven't given President Obama any kind of competition all the way back to 2004 when it was Alan Keyes that came in carpet bagged for 90 days in Illinois and got trounced here. So 2004 Republicans really didn't oppose him. In 2008, Sarah Palin was on that ticket. And in 2012, Mitt Romney was on that ticket. So you have to look at the fact that the Democrats are not really developing their talent the way they need to, and the Republican Party does drive out their base during these midterm elections in a way that, if nothing else, it does come through the media. The Democrats still have the better ground game. It's just the fact that they have been controlling a lot of these state legislatures until recently. They control all of the cities, and they still have been controlling at least the Senate through from 2006 onward, and people are still dealing with the down economy. And now that President Obama has been there since 2009, they're not looking at President Bush anymore. They are still looking at President Obama, and the narratives that worked in 2008 and even in 2012 are not going to work anymore. So when it comes to 2014, they're going to have to change the narrative as well as some of the strategy on the ground.
I mean, even if you talk about gerrymandering, I mean, Maryland's a perfect example of how Democrats can gerrymander a map, where Republicans have been gerrymandered right out of Congress in the state of Maryland, except for one, and where majority and minority districts in Maryland, there could have been a third one. There wasn't because of the political power, Steny Hoyer, who didn't want to lose his potential district because his district is that district. So that game is played both ways, Edward. It's not like a Republican game only. And maybe our political system is just arcane when it comes to how we develop and elect people.
I agree with you, Mark. I think that I understand that gerrymandering benefits both parties, right? But what I was specifically talking about is because I don't see that changing, right? I don't, in the same way that we see Harry Reid isn't willing to push on trying to abolish the filibuster rule, I don't see these arcane rules changing in our political system. And so I really was trying to open up the eyes of Democrats specifically to see that they actually need a better, they need to be playing a better ground game, because otherwise, essentially what's going to happen, and this is really the heart of it, is that Republicans will ensure, if they hold on to the House and maybe gain in the Senate, that President Obama's second term is pretty much obsolete. They've already shown that they're completely obstinate on anything that actually matters to the American people, like immigration reform and gun control. And they essentially want to have made him a one-term president by completely obstructing his second term. And so if they actually expect for this man to have a real legislative legacy beyond the Affordable Care Act, the Democrats are going to have to get those young people, have to get African Americans, have to get Asians and Hispanics to buy into the message and see that without their support, basically electing Obama in 2012 didn't really matter that much.
So what would happen if there wasn't a Republican boogeyman for the Democrat to chase after like there was in 2009? Immigration could have been done in 2009. That's why Telemundo and Univision held him accountable in 2012 and said, why didn't you get this done when you had the supermajority in place where you can have the Republican boogeyman that was nothing more than a four-year-old in the corner screaming and giving temper tantrums? That's what you had then. Immigration didn't get done then. Gun control didn't get done then, and the economy didn't really get Americans back to work. The main focus was that ACA that was the coveted, exclusively partisan bill that they wanted to get through, and now, because there are very few plans in place, there's been a lack of leadership, even from a budget perspective in the Senate that's going on. The only way for the Democrats to move forward is to continue to point the finger at that four-year-old and blame everything on that. That's the Democrats' problem. It's not so much the ground game, and it's not so much how things are organized or gerrymandering. It's the fact that the Democrats have not come with plans that would work that should get government moving forward. President Obama had huge amounts of political capital that he has wasted throughout his presidency, and that's a darn shame.
And we are out of time, and you've had the last word for today, but I think that's a great place maybe for us to pick up next week, just where you left off. Lenny McAllister, media commentator, public speaker, writer, Jordan Bloom, associate editor of the American Conservative, Shad Johnson, news director at our sister station WVAS in Montgomery, Alabama, Edward Wyckoff Williams, author, columnist, and regular contributor to The Root. Gentlemen, thank you. Good to have you all with us.
God bless you. Thank you. Have a wonderful weekend.
You all, too. Have a great weekend. And, folks, we're going to take a little break. When we come back, we are going to go back to a local conversation and look at the battle of the World Farm Store and what a community does to control its own development. Stay with us. Don't go away.